5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
How about we do it again?
6, 7, 4, 3, 2, 1. I think I'm bored.
Okay, let's try one more time.
I definitely didn't.
Why can't we move you? Why can't we move you?
Six.
Five. 4. 3. 2. 1.
Welcome to this, the 260th episode of Rank and Review. My good friend Matthew Risling is finally back on the show, and we're going to talk about horror anthologies. Why have one big horror movie when you can have three or four little horror movies all at once? Matt's a wonderful guest to have, and we have to break down several mini stories, so the reviews might be slightly longer than usual, but I do think it will be worth your time. If you disagree, though, you can send your feedback to rankandreview@gmail.com. That's rankandreview@gmail.com. Please check out my website at rankandreview.ca. Support other podcasts like the Shelf Shedding Movie Show and A Lifetime of Hallmark. And please go into the episode understanding that there may be coarse language and spoilers. Particularly if you haven't seen the movie Ghost Stories from 2017, please watch it before you listen to this review, because we definitely undo that movie on a spoiler level. I hope you enjoy the 260th episode of Rank and Review. I got Mr. Matthew Risling back on the program. This is going to be the 260th episode of Rank and Review. Can you believe that shit?
No, the 100 seems like not that long ago, but I guess it was the better part of a decade ago now.
That was the first Coen Brothers episode we did. We're talking about anthologies. And I've always had an affection for horror anthologies, while at the same time understanding that they kind of run extremely hot and cold. Not just the movies themselves, but the stories within them. So, on one hand, it keeps me hopeful as a horror watcher, because if I don't like what's happening right now, 20 minutes from now, we're going to have a whole different story with a whole different cast of characters. So you can never necessarily entirely give up hope on anthologies. But I also like that they tend to be quick, brutal, you know, simple stories that get in and out except for a few that we'll talk about, tend to overstay their welcome. There's something to be said for a quick, punchy horror story, and that's what anthologies are here to deliver. So I've always been a fan. The original Creepshow was a big part of my childhood. So I think, you know, I come in a fan, but where are you? What do you feel about anthologies? I kind of thrust this one upon you. So,
no, I really like anthologies. When I was a kid, I used to read a lot of horror comics, like those House of Mystery and like those ones, like the DC ones, and it was very similar. You know, the stories would be maybe 4 pages long. There would be the setup, something gets creepy, and then there's a weird twist, often an ironic twist, and then it would just move on to the next one. And kind of as with these anthology movies, a lot of the stories weren't very good, but I think what I liked was not the shortness of them, but how imaginative they were, because you could just have like a stupid idea, and, you know, in a comic book, just play it out over 4 pages, or, you know, like in a movie, if you've got 15 minutes, you can have a movie about a haunted pair of chattering teeth or whatever. It's like utterly ridiculous, but also we're moving on quickly. So it's like, I don't know, it's a place to let your imagination shine.
Yeah.
Steve, I've always thought short form anthologies or comics was generally a better movie or a better medium for most horror than full length novels or full length movies.
Well, I like the quick in and out, like just get the job done type of thing. Here's the horror premise and here's the horror payoff. Now let's move on. It's very simple and it gives you a quick, delicious payoff. But I think it was Stephen King was talking about sometimes stories that, you know, you want to be grounded in a real reality. And sometimes there are stories that just happen because they happen. There's a finger that sticks out of the drain in your sink one day, and what the fuck is that? And a lot of the times they don't sustain a novel. They don't really sustain, like, they're just a little bit too out there. And honestly, sometimes they're maybe a little bit too out there for a movie, for an anthology movie. We're gonna have a scene where a bunch of severed hands are running around, like Thing from the Addams Family, and it's supposed to be like scary, but it's kind of absurd, right? But I am not entertained by it. Like, it's kind of a crazy huge swing that they're taking, you know?
Well, and I have to say, I can't say that these were all good movies. I can't even say that these were mostly good movies, but I did enjoy every one of them to varying degrees. And sometimes, like, the stupidity of it is a charming point. Like, there are some on this list that I think were done relatively well, but those are a little bit less charming than some of the really ridiculous out there ones, which actually makes this a hard list to rank, because you're like, you have to weigh the quality versus the charm, and I tend to be a bit of a sucker for charm.
Best versus favorite. I've been running into this again and again lately on the podcast. There are movies that I can say this is the best movie, but I still think this is my favorite movie. And when those two types of movies run into each other on the podcast, it causes problems for me.
Well, yeah, this time my ranking system this time is purely in order of the ones that I enjoyed the most. Very often I will use criteria of like what I would recommend to somebody, but I mean, if you're into horror anthologies, you would kind of like almost all of these, and if you're not, you wouldn't like any of them. So, you know, they just, some of the weird ones I enjoyed.
I think two of them, specifically the ones that were presented as pilots, Quicksilver Highway and Body Bags, are very, very 90s. Like, if you weren't sort of into that vibe or watching a lot of TV in that era, it might feel kind of tactily strange to you almost. They just don't make them like that anymore.
Mm-hmm. In fact, one of my notes on almost all of these is that this was a very 90s list. I think this was maybe the most 90s list you've given me. And not just because most of them were made in the 90s, but most of them feel like the 90s.
They are the 90s. Is there anything else you want to say by way of introduction before I list off these films and we talk about some anthology horror?
No, in fact, I think this episode might run a little bit long because each of these is like three mini-movies.
Yeah, so let's just get into it. Thank you so much for doing this, and I'm glad that you had fun with it again, because I was force-feeding you these these episodes. So,
it's always a pleasure.
We're going to talk about John Carpenter's Body Bags. We're going to talk about Creepshow 2. We're going to talk about Tales from the Dark Side, the movie. And we're going to talk about an English movie called Ghost Stories. And they're doing animated anthology, our second animated anthology, it occurs to me.
We did the Edgar Allan Poe one.
Yeah. This is called Fears of the Dark. It's very French. And we'll finish with another 90s pilot called Quicksilver Highway. With Christopher Lloyd.
We're saving the best for last, aren't we?
Damn straight. Thanks for being here, brother.
Something's coming.
Maybe I'll see you around.
I see things.
I think maybe I can help you.
Something strange.
Weird.
Gruesome.
Painful. Sexy.
Yes, yes!
When can we do it? Something shocking.
Your brain are the only food on which we can thrive.
What have you done to me? Something terrifying.
I had to
finished digging your grave.
John Carpenter presents Body Bags.
So very recently, a mutual acquaintance of ours, Rayleigh Perkins, was on the show, and we talked about John Carpenter's Memoirs of the Invisible Man. Carpenter did not have a good experience on that, and he wanted to rapidly sort of change direction of what he was doing, and he got hands of the script for Body Bags, which is going to sort of a proposed anthology horror TV series for cable. And he thought, this could be a fun thing that I could do, and I could do an episode here and there in between my movie projects and kind of keep limber. And, you know, when I get to my, you know, down spots, I have sort of a place to be a creative outlet. And
yeah, and this is, sorry, right around the time that there was the Friday the 13th anthology and the Nightmare on Elm Street anthology, right? So this kind of thing, you can't say it was hot exactly, but they were making them.
There was a strange, like, popularity of them. In the 80s, there was, like, the Tales from the Dark Side, and that kind of got eclipsed into HBO's Tales from the Crypt, which, because they had money and had more content, less content restrictions, just blew Tales from the Dark Side kind of out of the water. But I think that, yeah, there was interest in seeing if this could play. It's a tougher sell on TV in a weird way for me than in a movie, because it's hard to get people to return week to week when they don't know what they're getting week to week. With TV, I feel like people really want to know what they're going to get, and they couldn't hear. But the project kind of became bigger because he ended up being the host of this show, and they did a substantial makeup on him. And Carpenter, who's done cameos in a few things here and there, I think he's actually a pretty decent actor as far as his, you know, being an over-the-top presenter and, like, for what he's being asked to do. This is not his typical wheelhouse, and I don't know.
No,
I thought
he was good. That was one of my first notes, is that he seemed very comfortable in front of the camera. I wasn't sure if that was a lot of makeup or if he just looked really bad, because John Carpenter kind of looks like the Crypt Keeper anyway in some sense.
I think today he could host it without makeup, but in 92, no, he was actually caked in makeup while he was doing that. But, so, it's an interesting mix, and it's not entirely his. He didn't write the script, it doesn't have the John Carpenter score, but it does have a weird John Carpenter vibe. And when I say weird, I definitely mean weird. This is also the age where the most influential thing on TV was a little show called Twin Peaks.
Oh, really? Yeah, I guess that's right, isn't it?
Yeah, and I really do feel like this strange, like, weird soundtrack, the swishy jazzy soundtrack, and, like, some of the scenes playing a little bit longer and a little bit archer than they otherwise would, I think is sort of the influence of the weirdo vibe that was infecting TV at the time. Northern Exposure and all these other TV shows just had to be super weird. And I also think that's a little bit present here. So I think if you were roughly our age and you saw this when it was relatively new, it would be a comfortable, easy watch for you. Watching it for the first time today, I feel like there's a little bit of a fence to climb for outsiders. I think the first story about a woman being chased around a gas station is pretty industry standard, but does the job. The second story about a guy trying to get hair to grow in his head, I think is hilarious.
Yeah, that one,
it's hilarious that one in a way that is pleasing to
one
me.
One of the weirdest. On this list, there were some that went into surreal, goofy territory, and that was that was the first of them.
And I mean, I got to give it to Stacey Keach; he absolutely delivers in that segment. And then we have the third segment with Mark Hamill, just absolutely committed to playing this guy who's possessed by. It's basically a mini version of the old movie Body Parts. In this case, he gets somebody else's eye, and it changes his entire personality and possesses him, and he ends up being very violent towards Twiggy. Anybody remember who Twiggy was or care who Twiggy is?
I read about Twiggy in a Mad magazine once when they were making fun of her. But to the eye being a very similar part to Body Parts, the 90s really liked that. That was like a whole genre of thing, because there was Body Parts, there was Idle Hands, there was a Simpsons episode that was like a parody of it where Homer got the hair transplant.
That's right.
I mean, that's just off the top of my head, but when I was watching this, I was like, why does this seem so familiar? But I think I watched like 5 or 6 shows like this with that basic plot.
The strange thing for me about Body Bags is the middle story, the hair loss story, the comedy story, the kind of obviously quote-unquote worst story, is my favorite. It's the least funny and the most absurd, but there's something about it to me. And it's got David Warner in it. I always love that actor. Our friend Jeremy Cook's a big fan of him. If you want a guy to give you exposition in a horror movie, you get David Warner. Well, you used to. He's no longer with us, unfortunately. But I'm overall a fan, but it's hard to get enthusiastic about Body Bags. But what did you think? Do you have a favorite story? Am I crazy?
Yeah, you're crazy. The hair transplant was clearly the worst one, although it was the most memorable, so it makes sense that you would go there. So for me, the first one is pretty, like you said, pretty industry standard. There's a student, and she gets a job working graveyards at the gas station, and there's some sort of a psycho killer on the loose, and it's like, even if you haven't seen it, you've kind of seen it. You know, she's hearing noises, there's going to be a jump scare. There was a jump scare where she got kind of lured into the washroom, and then there was some grotesque drawing on one of the stalls, and that actually made me jump. In fact, this movie list, a couple of the jump scares really worked on me, even like the dumb ones like this. But one of the things that I thought worked well, there's a couple of things that worked well for me with the gas station one. On a purely aesthetic level, they did a really good job of toning down the ambient music, which is something that can get on my nerves a lot, especially with horror, when you've got, like, you know, the director saying, I want to create a mood, and so there's like and it's on to make you feel tense, and it's like, come on. Like, the scarier thing is her walking around this empty gas station at night and there's absolutely no sound, and I think that's why the jump scare worked, because you know, you and I have both worked graveyards and retail. Like, we know what that's like. It can be creepy.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, so she's in this little locked booth, and there's only one key, and the guy says, don't forget the key, because the door will lock behind you automatically. And I mean, everybody knows where this is going, but I think it's my retail experience as well, just, like, getting so anxious, like, don't forget the fucking key inside the booth, like, it's gonna kill me. So I don't know, that one did a legitimate good job of building suspense for a while. The ending when the psycho killer finally shows himself is no big thing, but the build up to that I thought was pretty effective.
It's a fine suspenseful story, but it is like a series of this woman walking down a slow dark hallway, like, it repeated. And I mean, it's a classic horror template for a reason, and it does work, but there's nothing new about it at all.
But if it had been like a feature-length movie,
no, it wouldn't make it.
But, you know, it's like a 12-minute vignette. It was fine.
Sure. I think why the hair one sort of spoke to me is the humor in it. The Stacey Keach trying all these desperate ways, like painting his hair, and then his wife kisses the top of his head and she's got ink all over her face, and he just starts laughing at himself and the whole pathetic situation. I don't have a problem with hair loss, but I guess I'm sympathetic to people who are, and he really thinks this is going to make his life better at getting it. Like, the hair is going to be that's the thing that's going to fix his world. And it's such a strange approach. I don't know why. I wasn't expecting this story. Like, I guess I knew where the story was going. You know where all of these stories are going, but it felt different. I don't know how else to put it.
Well, so there was a couple of things that stuck out to me. One, I don't know if you're at all a fan of early 1980s Quebec cinema, but there's this weird movie called The Peanut Butter Solution.
Okay.
Where some kid gets scared and he goes bald, and then like this gypsy couple or whatever
trying to fix it,
this recipe for, yeah, and then his hair starts growing out of control and it becomes kind of like this preteen body horror. And I saw it at the Broadway Theater when I was quite young, and it wasn't scary, but it was a little bit upsetting,
troubling,
and the same thing happens here when he gets his hair transplant and it starts growing out of control. I got some real peanut butter solution vibes.
And some icky
the
things
other vibe
like
I got was
hair growing in his mouth. Like, that would be gross.
Yeah, I made a note about that too, because that was like full on good body horror when he just like keeps pulling at it. It reminded me actually a lot of an episode from Creepshow 1, the one where Stephen King finds a meteorite, and then he starts getting like this fungus or moss growing all over his body. And it had a similar ick factor.
Yeah. I get that it's goofy.
When the individual hairs with their little high-pitched voices, you know, they do the close-ups of them, it really kind of destroys any mood that it's attempting to create.
I laughed out loud. I don't know what to say. It was so fucking crazy. And that'll take us to, yes, Mark Hamill. There was a time, like, I think in his heyday, where you could argue that maybe Mark Hamill was overrated. Well,
so I don't know. I think Mark Hamill is a consummate actor. So when he was playing young Luke Skywalker in Episode 4, he wasn't very good yet.
Right.
But every role that he's in, he throws himself into entirely. Whether it's the Joker or in the Jay and Silent Bob movie.
There are no half measures taken by Mr. Hamill, and damn it, I respect it. Like, I think he became super famous before, you know, he had it, but over the decades, he has earned it. Like, I don't know who would have done this role this way, and I don't know if it's because it's Mark Hamill that I'm so distracted by it, but I really appreciate how much he's going for it here. Like, I don't feel like he's embarrassed, I don't feel like he's slumming it, I feel like this is awesome, right?
No, it's like, you know, he made a cameo in Stephen King's Sleepwalkers a couple of years after this, and
yeah.
It was the same thing, he brought it all, and considering how rich he is from all the Luke Skywalker merchandise, he doesn't have to be doing this, but he's just, like, into it.
If he's doing something, it's because he wants to, and that's an enviable position to be in. So, how interesting that he wants to be in body bags. Maybe he wanted to work with John Carpenter. Also, fun horror movie, nerdy fact, the coroner that shows up at the end is Toby Hooper, famous horror director in his own right.
Toby Hooper and Sam Raimi has a brief cameo as well.
And there's a big twist that the guy, the host, the coroner, who's been telling us these stories, is not in fact a coroner. He's one of the bodies. And then the credits roll, and that doesn't really matter at all. I don't know how they're going to sustain that week to week, but the wraparound thing is something that maybe is worth talking about. Different anthologies handle it in different ways. I think for me, maybe the best case is the original Creepshow with the little kid reading the comic book and the payoff with the voodoo doll. But almost always the wraparound, it's kind of necessary, but kind of dead air for the movie.
So I was kind of thinking about that because I don't think all of these have a frame narrative, do they? Or do they?
Fears of the Dark and Ghost Stories doesn't, but the rest of them I think sort of do.
Yeah, and I was wondering why they all, like, because some of them seem so perfunctory, and, like, do they just have them because that's what people usually do, or is that, like, and this is a question for you, is it adding something for the most part?
I think it's a layover from those old comics you were talking about. I used to read, like, Grimm's Ghost Stories, do you remember those, or like, and there was always a skeleton or a crypt keeper or a host that was like...
Yeah, it's always a narrator of some sort.
And they prime you a little bit. They let you know, okay, we're going to a museum in Chicago and a weird package is being delivered. Now watch, kiddies. And again, that really does speak like a TV type of show. And if we have a, quote, host in the movie, it's our only character that we can count on in a weird way, because like I said, all the stories are going to hit the reset button. I think Body Bags is for a specific audience, but if you're in it, you will like it, but it's a hard one to enthusiastically endorse to just anyone, right?
Yeah, like I said, I probably can't recommend most of these, but I enjoyed watching Body Bags.
So as I said before, I was a big fan of the original Creepshow. Stephen King wrote it. George A. Romero directed it. It told 5 stories in 2 hours and pretty efficiently well-executed movie. And it made a lot of money. It's one of George Romero's few, like, Grand Slam hits. So, yes, let's make Creepshow 2. But Romero's now just writing the screenplay, and he's adapted 2 Stephen King short stories and 1, I guess, premise from Stephen King that he kind of took off on his own. But I think the major problem we have going into Creepshow 2 is right before production, a good chunk of money was taken from them, and they cut 2 stories out of it. And instead of having 5 again...
But for some reason, when they cut 2 stories, they kept the one about the wooden Indian.
That's right. I think the fact that each of these stories are stretched to a half an hour, with the exception of the second one, hurts them. I think that having them being a little bit tighter, especially the Chief Woodenhead episode, which I remember thinking was okay when I was younger, but when I watched this time, felt like it was an hour long. It just felt like it was going so slow.
Yeah, you really felt the extra length of that one.
But the first and the third one, I think, feel padded in a way that nothing felt padded in the original Creepshow. That said, there is some great special effects creature work in this. There's some, like, really awesome moments in it.
Yeah, it's Tom Savini, right?
Savini is in the movie as the creature, the creeper creature at the end of it. And he was involved in some of the production end of the movie, so...
So I was thinking, like, there were some shots that seemed just too good to be a hack special effects guy. Like, there was, like, when the Cheap Woodenhead episode, when one of the guys gets shot by an arrow, like, it's just such a Savini-style gag that I thought that he had to have had some input on it.
I don't know how involved, but I would not in any way be surprised, because he and Romero were buds, and, like, I think he was invested in the Creepshow franchise. One of the favorite things he ever did was design the creature for the crate in the original. Because he very rarely gets asked to design monsters. He usually does, like, blood effects and, like, violence. Well, here's another problem with Creepshow 2. I mean, I'm not this guy who's, like, in the age of wokeness and, like, we could and shouldn't do this. But in Old Chief Woodenhead, which plays on, like, really grotesque native stereotypes, the main villain is being played in brownface.
Yeah.
And...
Yeah, I looked the actor, who's actually a good actor, he's in the show Mindhunter.
Yep.
But I think he's Irish, right? Or he's, like, Irish-American?
Yeah, I'm not sure of his background, but he is wearing brown face, and he's got the whole thing about that character is that he's rejected his own culture, and he's becoming this criminal. He's stealing these ancient artifacts, and he's going to go to Hollywood and become famous because of how beautiful he is. And I have a real hard time...
Well, not just how beautiful he is,
but
his hair is.
Yeah.
It's all leading up to the most obvious he's going to get scalped at the end.
But it's weird how I honestly didn't notice it. It's because I've become familiar with the actor that when I watched it this time, I saw it. And how any part of me that still wanted to defend Old Chief Woodenhead for, like, just the violence and the simplicity of the story, it died. It died when I saw that. It's just like, really? There was no native actor that you could cast? And, like, this is, like, got to be, what, 88, 89? Like,
it's... Maybe a little earlier, like 86, 87?
Something like that. But I don't know. I hate to be this guy, but once I noticed that, I stopped wanting to like the segment. Is that... Because when I was younger, I did get off on the vengeance. I thought that the sweet old couple didn't deserve to be murdered, and Old Chief Woodenhead was good on him for taking his revenge. And yes, of course he takes scalps, because of course he does, right? Like,
well, actually, my bigger problem, although the brown face was off-putting, but it was George Kennedy's aw shucks. Like, he was just laying the aw shucks store owner on so thick that you just cannot wait until this guy gets killed.
The first 15 minutes of this story is just dead. Like, it's just unbelievable. You want the criminals to come and shoot up the store just so something happens. And it's not a long story, so it is pretty impressive how right away they kind of derail things. Happily, the second story, The Raft, is fucking amazing.
Yeah, so you talked a lot about how influential Creepshow was on you as a child. For me, it was Creepshow too. And even as a kid, I didn't like the Cheap Wooden Head episode particularly, but The Raft, I think, is just one of my favorite like episodes in any horror anthology ever. It's so, well, it's not scary exactly, but it's just claustrophobic. You feel trapped.
Four college friends go out to swim to this raft late in the season after all of the tourists have gone home, and they swim up to the raft, and this weird oil slick looking thing starts approaching them, and clearly it's trying to eat them. And anytime any of them so much as touches the water or gets too close to the water, their numbers start to dwindle. And it's a vicious, ugly, mean-spirited story. And so is the short story it took from. The one thing
and
that...
And also, they don't die well.
At all.
When the first girl, Rachel, gets... like, so it must have like a hypnotic effect or something, right? Because she kind of jumps into it. Mm-hmm. And then, like, the... whatever, the corrosive blob eating away her skin while she's screaming how much badly it hurts.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, if this wasn't already, it's not even suspenseful at this point. I suppose it's still suspenseful for the ones on the raft, but, like, the stakes are very clear at that point.
Yeah. Well, and the story is also very mean-spirited. Like, Deke, the lead guy, is kind of a huge, violent asshole and not really good at dealing with this. I think that the two things that they changed for the story from the original source, like, you're very right to intuit, the creature had these weird colors that it would sort of express, like gasoline on the water or something like that. And I think the idea was if you stared at it long enough, you would be hypnotized and you would just fall into it and you wouldn't feel being eaten. But the kids are too busy being scared and fighting this to realize that. The last character in the short story sort of looks at that as his Hail Mary pass, and it leaves with him staring at it, hoping that he's right. But in the movie, they make the two changes, and the thing can leap out of the water at them in the movie, and there is a sexual assault scene that happens in the movie. And
so, like, I thought that the rapey scene at the end, because it wasn't like the football player asshole, it was the nice guy,
right?
So I was wondering if the creature, whatever it was, you know, its hypnotic powers were turning him more vicious in some way.
I think it's played differently and better in the story, in that it's more about them being terrified, alone, and freezing cold. They don't even particularly like each other, but they have sex to, I don't know, just to somehow deal with the situation. Whereas in the movie, she's asleep and he starts touching on her. And it's a already ugly story that they thought, how can we make this uglier?
Well, so I decided to give the story the benefit of the doubt that somehow, because this isn't like a horny situation,
no.
So why would it be going on? And this creature seems to have something going on psychically, so maybe it was infecting his mind. I don't know. It's never really well established.
For me, the as it's called in the story, the Deke tree sequence, where Deke tries to dive off the boat or the raft, but before he can, it squeezes between the boards and literally pulls his entire body through the boards of the raft. And it's a slow, snappy, gross, painful process, which the two surviving friends just watch because there's nothing else that they can do. And both in the story and in the movie, it's fucking traumatizing. Like, wow, well done. And they did not have a big budget, and apparently that water was freezing. So good on all of the actors.
You were saying that when you were talking about in the story how cold it was, because you could see their breath.
Yeah.
Like, that would have been a miserable shoot.
Yeah, I believe it. And apparently they didn't have a lot of hope on the... It was basically a floating plastic thing with debris that they were sort of navigating about the water. But on the day, it didn't look that great. But through the editing, somehow, they made that shit work. And yes, You are forgiven for Chief Woodenhead. Okay, so we're just gonna... These two are gonna cancel each other out. Which leads us to...
Well, and actually...
Sorry?
Sir, I just want to say about the blobby thing, because it kind of looked like black plastic garbage bags or whatever strewn together, but that sort of helped it. Like, it kind of looked like garbage that you find when you're at the lake, and, you know, as a kid, it's easy to imagine that that can
suddenly
become corrosive and kill you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it fucked with me a lot.
Oh, no, that was haunting to me as a child. Like, I was traumatized by the crate in the original Creepshow, but other than, you know, my dad teasing me about it and us having a crate in the garage, I didn't have any real-world scares. But if I was swimming at a lake, or if I was just at a lake, oh, I would think about Creepshow, too. The last story is, thanks for the ride, lady. This is a classic Stephen King unlikable protagonist who spends a lot of time talking to herself. I find this thing that a lot of times when people are adapting Stephen King, they do, because the characters have such an inner life, they don't know how to express it other than to have the characters just talk to themselves. And I don't know, I find it, they almost never pull it off, right? Like, almost never. But the basic, again, A, B, and C. She hits a guy on the road, she drives away, she does the wrong thing, she's wrestling with herself, can she live with it? She's already got a pretty broken moral compass, as we can find, but...
Well, yeah, because when we meet her, she's, like, with a
gigolo.
Sex worker,
yeah.
And she's talking about how she doesn't like her husband, but she likes his money. And so, you know, by the time she hits the hitchhiker, oh, also she's late, right, because
yeah.
Her husband is very punctual, and all of the clocks have gone out... So, you know, she's got to rush home. And it's just, like, it seems like something this character would do.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the character's well enough established.
No, we don't like her, but we just want to see what happens. Because this hitchhiker keeps on showing up, and she keeps on running him over again. And he shows up again, and she runs him over again. And he shows up again, and he runs him over. And it, repeat. Like, that is the sequence. But, I mean... There are some impressive car stunts, and there are some very impressive makeup effects. The screenplay is the least impressive thing about it, but again, if we're comparing it to old Chief Woodenhead, like I think this one works well enough. It's not better than The Raft. It's not better than The Raft.
No, this one's not better than The Raft. I like the screenplay more than you did. Again, it's kind of like the gas station one that we were talking about, where it's very... like ABC, there's no surprises along the way, but I think it's well paced, and they do a good enough job casting doubt about whether or not there is this zombie ghost after her, whether it's her guilty conscience, because at the end, you know, when he gets her in her garage, she's actually choking herself, like he's
yeah.
not the one that killed her. Yeah, she has a monologue about how it was all a dream that kind of sucked. But, you know, I thought it was okay.
Yeah. And okay is right. The reason to watch Creepshow 2 is The Raft. They have this really cheap Saturday morning cartoon sort of animation that wraps everything around. And it's such a step down from the original. I don't know why it couldn't have just been another kid reading another comic book. That would have been lazy, but... The animated carnivorous plant didn't do anything for me, and I don't know, it seemed like the cheap kind of choppy animation that we would be watching on Saturday morning. It didn't feel like a movie somehow.
Yeah, my note on the animation is it felt like Ralph Bakshi in his most cost-cutting years. Not quite Saturday morning style, because there was a certain fluidity, but very cheap. They're using like a third of the animation cells. And the, you know, the gag at the end where the kid's buying these seeds for these carnivorous plants and they eat the bullies, like you kind of know that that's going to happen by the, you know, like the first intermission.
But even though there's minimal animation in the first Creepshow as they transition from the real world into the comic book world, it's just that. It's just for that moment. The fact that we have scenes and characters that are done in this animated world, just, it takes any fright out of it. There's nothing scary about the Saturday morning cartoon I'm watching right now. Like, let's get to the next story.
Well, and that's the one that made me first think about, like, are these frame narratives really adding anything?
Mm-hmm.
Because in one of them, they really do. One of them, the frame narrative is part of the overall narrative. But otherwise, I don't know. What do you lose if you cut it?
Or, yeah, just smash to black and give a title, and this is the next story? I don't know. I think that the screenplay writers get nervous about, like, these transitions. They feel like they need to have something to ease the audience from one story to the next. But it's a delicate thing. Give me like an Elvira figure. Show us some cleavage. And now our next story, right?
Yeah, I would take that.
I like but do not love Creepshow 2. It's mainly the raft that makes it worth watching. And I think upon this viewing, when I return to it again, I really would just bypass Chief Woodenhead and watch the second two stories. Like, it starts very weak, but it does get better. It's worth your time.
Stephen King, originator of Pet Sematary. Arthur Conan Doyle, author of Sherlock Holmes. Michael McDowell, creator of Beetlejuice. George Romero, director of Night of the Living Dead. Now, these four masters of everlasting horror bring to the screen four tales of overwhelming terror.
I warned them, but they wouldn't listen.
Tales of diabolical fate.
You promised you'd never die!
Tales of ghastly revenge.
Grow, O light. Rise, O light. Come forth, O light. Open his eyes.
Tales of ruthless evil.
That cat has killed three people in this household.
I don't believe this.
Kill it, bury it, and bring me its tail.
Tales from the dark side.
Well, that just about takes care of that, doesn't it?
So contrary to what you might have heard, there is no Creepshow 3. I mean, there is a Creepshow 3 in that somebody produced a movie called Creepshow 3, and it's absolutely terrible, has nothing to do with Stephen King, has nothing to do with Romero. But spiritually, Creepshow 3 is actually Tales from the Dark Side. George Romero is involved, Stephen King is involved, a lot of the same creative people are involved. And it's got really decent production values, which is funny if you ever watched the original TV series that this was based on. It's an embarrassingly cheaply produced TV series that did actually have some good episodes.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about it at all until you started talking about it earlier, but when you were saying it was low budget, like my God, it got like Steve Buscemi, Christian Slater, Debbie Harry, James Remar. Like, it's, you can't quite say it's an all-star cast, but...
No, like, but the original TV series, the TV series was dirt cheap. They spent some money on the movie, but the TV series had a lot of people before they were famous on it, too. One of my favorite episodes has, like, a 12-year-old Christian Slater in it. I think, again, that was a TV series produced by Romero. For some reason, they couldn't do another Creepshow movie, so why not do Tales from the Dark Side? This one has an interesting wraparound story for me. I mean, the little kid actor is not amazing, but I'm willing to look past these sorts of things. Deborah Harry, Blondie herself, is a witch, and she has a little boy in a cage in her house, and she is prepping the kitchen to cook him. But while there...
Yeah, I thought that was going to be a reveal, because when she was coming in, you know, there was like an old-timey broomstick up against the fridge. I'm like, oh, is she going to be a witch? Is that they're going to pull the rug? But no, she was just like a witch from the beginning.
Yeah, and she's all business about it. She's like very... She's not laughing and cackling and, you know, she's not a hocus-pocus kind of witch. She's a very modern girl witch. And she's got this kid in her little dungeon there. And he's trying to work the clock by reading her stories out of this book. Which is weird. She says it's her favorite book, and yet she seems to be surprised by all of the stories as they are being read to her.
So I assumed it was a magic book where there's different stories every time you read it. That's the only way that I could make sense of that.
But I mean, as far as your wraparound segments go, this works well enough for me. Like, you're minimally invested, and you know there's going to be a payoff at the end of the movie. Either the boy's going to get eaten by the witch, or the witch is going to be killed by the boy. Which will it be? Let's wait and see. So, on that level, yeah, I think it works well enough. Yeah.
I also thought it did a good job. Oh, shoot. Who's the guy that did Midnight Mass?
Flanagan?
Yeah, it was like Mike Flanagan's take on Edgar Allan Poe in his most recent Netflix series, because all of these stories are based on, like, respectively, there's a Sir Arthur Conan Doyle story, an Edgar Allan Poe story, and then, like, a Japanese folktale. But all of them, they change enough so that it's not beat for beat the same. It's like remaking the vibe a bit.
That's right.
And I thought it was an interesting take on it. I thought they did a good job with all of them.
The first story is the most star-studded. Again, at the time, Steve Buscemi hadn't popped yet. Reservoir Dogs hadn't happened yet. He was a working actor. Christian Slater, I think, was arguably starting to pop because I think Pump Up the Volume came out this same year.
Yeah, and he had been in Name of the Rose before that.
I think he was on the rise for sure. But Julianne Moore had been in a soap opera. Again, she'd won an award for playing twins or something on a soap opera that I didn't watch, but she was on the rise, but, you know, no one was like, ooh, ooh, Julianne Moore, right? Steve Buscemi has...
Did she look, like, weirdly 35 or 40 years old to you? Like, she would have been in her early 20s, but she had that, like, old lady look that everybody had in the early 90s.
There's something about the big hair perms and the too much makeup made a lot of people look like middle-aged aunts prematurely. I don't know what that was about. I've always found Julianne Moore attractive, though, so I'm not gonna talk shit about her. Shibashimi acquires a mummy, and he has been perpetually bullied and screwed over by these rich dicks. It's sort of the, you know, it's a slobs versus snob story that's complicated by a reanimated mummy. And again, I don't think anything about the story is particularly surprising except for the quality of the cast and the special effects, right? Mummy is resurrected, mummy takes revenge, there's a twist, and it's fine.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. I was struck by how much Steve Buscemi looked like. You're going to have to remind me of the guy's name. The guy that did all those 1980s Lovecraft movies.
Jeffrey Combs.
I guess two of them. He was in the... Jeffrey Combs. Did Steve Buscemi not have, like, a real Jeffrey Combs vibe in that?
Well, Jeffrey Combs could have done that role, so, like... It's almost like Haunted by Jeffrey Combs. It almost should have been his part, right? It's the type of role he would play. And there is something about that.
Yeah, I was wondering if, like, he bailed at the last minute, so they hired this weird-looking guy to play the exact same character that he plays.
To take nothing against Steve Buscemi, either. I think he's really good in it. And even though he's kind of a put-upon victim to the other people, his willingness to go to a very dark place to get revenge kind of sours him a little bit as a character. But he's an interesting actor. He's always been an interesting actor, so I liked it.
Yeah, I mean, he's a sympathetic character for about 2 minutes mm-hmm. until you can tell that he's using this dark magic to get this mummy to start killing people, and then he turns into a villain pretty quickly. I was a little surprised that the mummy didn't end up killing him, as often happens in that kind of story.
Well, the different mummies ended up killing him, right? His own sister and her boyfriend are mummified and are paying him a visit at the end of the story.
Oh, no, sorry, they kill... Sorry, I got the characters mixed up. Sorry. They kill Christian Slater, but I thought they were going to kill Steve Buscemi.
Steve Buscemi, okay, I get you. We're on the same page. Anyway, I think we've made too much of a meal of that sort. It's fine, it's a good, like, entry-level story, but there it is.
Just one small note. The acting in it was really good, but everybody was really not at all... They didn't seem at all disturbed that mummies were killing people. When Christian Slater was having the conversation with him, he was tied up and he was going to set him on fire at the end. Like, he didn't look like somebody who had lost his sister and his best friend. And Julianne Moore, when she was getting attacked by that mummy, she seemed more annoyed than anything.
Well, yeah, I think, I don't know if Christian Slater is playing crazy towards the end there, or if he's just overhyping his you know, dollar store Jack Nicholson, right? Like, I think he's maybe overplaying it a little bit when he's like, I'm going to set a little fire and roast your nuts or whatever. He has that weird line. It's just like, I don't know. This is revenge for the murder of your sister. Maybe to respect the situation a little bit.
Emote a little bit.
Is the next story the cat? I want to say the next story is the cat. This is based off of a Stephen King short story. And again, one of these absurd things. Like, what if you hired a professional hitman to kill a cat and he couldn't do it? Again, the actors here elevate things a lot. And it's one of... I remember reading the short story and the idea of a cat forcing itself down somebody's throat. Again, so absurd. It's like, it almost shouldn't be a movie. It should only exist as a short story. But somehow, this is the segment that...
They pulled it off.
They did. Romero directed this segment, and I think they absolutely pulled it off in a way that kind of surprises me, because I think the story is ludicrous, but I had a lot of fun here.
Also, when the cat, every now and then, it would launch itself at the hitman, and they'd use a cat puppet.
Yes.
It looked quite a lot like the cat from that movie we watched years ago, The Haunting, like that 1960s one. It looked very much like they threw a puppet in some guy's face, and he was using his hand to keep it on his face.
This charms me, though.
You know, it was a very charming, you know, like, what are you going to do with it? Well, they had a budget, but I don't know. It was fine. It really did pay off when the cat crawled down his throat at the end.
Yeah. Weird thing that I noticed. I don't know why I have an affection for this little character actor lady. The old lady who gets smothered by the cat in her bed. That was the librarian from the Ghostbusters.
Oh, really?
I don't know. Fun fact. Again, it's a completely simple story. William Hickey plays this eccentric millionaire who hires the hitman, and I really like that actor. He looked like he was 90 years old for the last 40 years of his life. It's just really interesting,
you know,
dude.
That other guy, he played one of the drug lords on Breaking Bad. He's like one of those character actors that's in everything.
Right.
But he's also always looked 70 years old.
Well, it's worked out for him. Anyway. Mm-hmm. So when I did the Best of the 60s episode, I watched this anthology movie, which name is escaping me. Anyway, in the story, there was a guy who met a mysterious woman in the middle of a snowstorm who made him make a promise.
Sorry, is called Kwaiden.
Kwaiden, thank you. As I was watching the story play out, it seemed very familiar to me. It was like, I've seen this before. This is a really cool movie, but they're totally ripping off Tales from the Dark Side. This movie made in the 60s, right? No, this James Remar and Ray Don Chong do this story where that exact scenario happens. This struggling artist witnesses something absolutely horrific. Two friends of his are mauled to death by this crazy gargoyle creature, and it speaks to him and tells him, "You do not tell anybody you saw me ever, and I will let you live." And he raises a family and he succeeds in his art and he has children, and years go by and he keeps the secret until one day he can no longer bear it anymore. And guess what happens? When I first watched this movie, when it was new, this was the story that fucked with me the most out of all of them. I felt like I knew where it was going, but even when it went there, I kind of couldn't believe that it went there. The betrayal of the promise costs him his family, his career, and his life, and then we roll credits.
I liked this story. Known the original, which is kind of hauntingly, tragically beautiful and heartbreaking.
Whereas this is just viscerally gross.
Well, it was weirdly heartbreaking, but the problem was the gargoyle looked a lot like, it was like a mask from the band Gwar or something. It was really hard to take the, like, James Remar gave a great performance, and Ray Dong Chong gave a great performance, and you could feel the heartbreak, but then when she turns into that silly latex mask monster, you're like, oh, why show that in such full lighting?
Right. It's tough. I mean, this was definitely before CGI, or I mean, there was around, but you wouldn't use it for that kind of monster effect. Mm-hmm. And I think that because it's an articulated face, like it speaks, its mouth moves. Mm-hmm. We see through it right away. Like, you're right, they might have benefited from some smoke and shadow. But I think the story was strong enough that I got through it. And how violent it was. Like, she swipes off a dude's head. Like,
yeah, the kill of the bartender at the beginning. Not just his head. She takes off his hand first. And he's, you know, because we're going to be talking about another movie with hands that get cut off.
Yes.
They're very clean. They're like Adam's Family hands. But this one is like pulsing blood. And it looked gory and horrible. And he was screaming. And he looked to really be in pain. And then his head gets brutally ripped off. It was more than I was expecting for this movie.
And I think that kind of balanced out the rubberiness of the creature for me, was just how brutal it was. Like, she loves this guy, but she's still gonna bite out his throat, and we watch the whole thing go down, and it's nasty.
Yeah, you get this sense that she didn't really have a choice.
Yeah.
Then she flew out of the skylight with their monster kids and landed on a building, and the sun came and she turned into a gargoyle.
And her two kids are clutching to her legs.
Sort of
her. Yeah, it's brutal. And when we first see the statue, it's looking down into the loft where he's doing his artwork. So, like, that's probably how she fell in love with him, by stalking him from the rooftops, presumably, right? Mm-hmm. So he was selected. He, like, yeah, it's a bad deal for everybody involved. But I guess if you make a promise, you keep that promise. Is there a lesson to be learned here?
Yeah, although, I mean, in his defense, it wasn't like, you know, if a monster says do this or I'm going to kill you, like, it's not like really making a promise.
That's right.
But I guess it still counts.
No. And then that'll take us back to the wraparound story, where, surprise, surprise, the little boy is not going to be eaten by a witch. Unlike Creepshow 2, which we just talked about, even though it has fewer stories, they hold their weight, each of them, much better than Creepshow 2 managed that balance. And it is a worthy successor to Creepshow. I realize it is not a Creepshow sequel, but close enough for my books. Is there anything else you want to say about Tales from the Dark Side?
No, I thought it was... This is one that I would kind of recommend. It's very 90s, and the special effects aren't that great, but I think each of the stories was pretty fun to watch.
Yeah. And again, I don't think any of the stories would make a movie by themselves. They're really well selected for the short format, so cheers all around.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Professor Philip Goodman. I'm here today to share three apparently supernatural incidents with you, all of which seem deeply troubling.
Hello? Anyone there?
The spirit. The unquiet spirit.
Lights are on, nobody's home.
No, you're still there.
You don't believe, do you?
The brain sees what it wants to see. My job is to try and untangle the truth from the fiction.
No, 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 no.
So, Ghost Stories, written and directed by Jeremy Dyson and Andy Nyman. Andy Nyman also playing the main character in the movie. I was introduced to this British actor from a zombie series called Dead Set that aired like 10 years ago. He probably played one of the best Cooper characters in any zombie movie I've ever seen. He was just enraging. Until maybe Train to Busan, there was no more frustrating Cooper character in any zombie movie. So I kind of liked this dude, and I'd heard that he was making this movie and that it was based off of a stage piece that he and his friend had done. And then I ended up watching the movie, and I was expecting it to be sort of like, I don't know, a box type of horror movie because it was based on a stage. Like, watching the movie, I don't know how they presented it as a stage play. And I really, really, really like the movie, but it's weird that I really, really like a movie. Because, you know, things that I don't like about horror movies? I don't necessarily like the twist where, spoilers, it's all a dream. I don't particularly...
Actually, I'm going to jump ahead and say that was one of my notes, that for some reason the it was all a dream twist wasn't annoying.
Right.
But it's like usually, one of the most hack things.
I hate it. I usually hate it. Honestly, unless we're talking Alice in Wonderland or like it's a kid's movie, and then we're just sort of playing with the dream formula. That's fine. And I also, I don't like it when I feel like I know where the movie's going and I'm ahead of it. And I was both right and wrong that like I was sort of ahead of the movie and sort of not. The movie did pull a trick on me. It did. The twist did work. I kind of did a facepalm like when it happened, but I feel like it sets itself. The main character, as we understand, is this skeptic guy who's going to investigate these three cases. Who has this other guy who did basically made him struggle with his skepticism.
This TV psychic from the 70s, whom he really admired as a kid and inspired him, went missing, contacted him later, was no longer a skeptic, and said, you know, check out these three cases and come back if you're still skeptical.
And basically telling him, like, your idea of, like, living your life with the skeptic nature is a waste. You've wasted your entire life. Also, he keeps on seeing these troubling little visions here and there. With each individual story, not only do we get the individual ghost story, but weird visions that this guy sees, these sort of mixed up in his past. And I don't know that it's really reasonable to expect you to figure it all out the first time you watch it. But for me, I was like, okay, this is a story of a skeptic who's going to be convinced that ghosts exist. That's what it's going to be. It's going to be the defeat of his skeptical nature. And will this be good for him or will this be bad for him? And that sort of happens, but it also has a lot to do with his past, and it also has a lot to do with his processing of where he actually is in his life.
Yeah, so I had stumbled across this movie before. I didn't know, when you gave me this list, there was one called Ghost Stories, which is such a forgettable title that
right.
I forgot that I had seen it already. So it was sort of coming back to me when I was watching it, so I knew where it was going. And so with that in mind, I was trying to see if they were planting any kind of clues that you could do anything with, and I think they were. Like, all of the stories had to do with daddy issues, and the frame narrative starts with him talking about his own daddy issues. And also, there's numbers everywhere. Like, you can get a sense that these stories are connected, you know, like... The night watchman, he's leaning on a door. I don't know how many numbers there are. I guess there's 9 individual numbers that keep recurring, and they're in all of these scenarios. So they won't give away what's going on, but they'll give away that there's something going on that has to do with our protagonist.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of weird bird imagery and a lot of imagery of these strange kids, which we, again, find out associate with his past. But I'm too busy waiting to see how the movie's going to break this guy's character, right? And he's already broken. And everything that we see is skewed. And you don't understand that until you've seen the movie in its entirety. So it's tricky. I ended up putting this in my top 10 of the decade when we did our ranks. Upon revisiting it, I think I would still put it on the list. I might have put it higher. But the reason I put it, like, was so impressed by it is that the movie handled me. I watch a lot of movies, and I, you know, whether I mean to be or not, I keep my ear to the ground for the twist and try to be a little bit ahead of things. And this movie pulled it off. They did the thing where it was all a dream, and I wasn't mad at it. Oh, and also, there's some really frightening sequences in the movie. So,
well, so that's another note that I had that goes along with why the it's all a twist thing wasn't so bad, because I think all of the stories were pretty tropey. Like, you get where they're all going. You know, there's a night watchman at a creepy place and then creepy things happen, but it, like, even though I'd seen it before, it was still pretty creepy. Like, it could get a little hard to watch. I had to, you know, think about putting my hands over my eyes for a second or two there.
Yeah, well, and I think the theme this time watching through it, again, having the benefit of knowing everything going into the from the beginning, the sort of theme of stagnation. The idea, like, he visits his father, who's in a frozen sort of catatonic state, and the way that the Night Watchman feels trapped there because of the medical situation of his daughter, the way the kid who's scared by the creature in the forest feels like he's locked into his room now forever, he can't leave. Like, everybody's trapped either in their head or in a physical space, and that's reflective of the Andy Nyman's character. He's literally laying catatonic, retelling himself these stories, presumably over and over and over again. So it's there, but you have to know to look for it, and you can't know to look for it the first time you watch it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also, I think all of the performances were really good. Weirdly, who's the guy that plays Bilbo Baggins?
Martin Freeman.
He's good in everything. Surprisingly, he wasn't the best performance. I thought the guy that played the security guard was really good. And the kid, who he was in The Imitation Game, I think he's been in a bunch of things, but his performance was really good as well. But what was his name? Rifkind.
Yeah. The middle story was the one that I had the hardest time putting my finger on, as far as, like, the weird creature in the car and, like, the whole... thematically how that fit in with the other ones. It didn't even feel like it was a ghost story on some level.
Well, it wasn't. It was like two monsters in the forest.
Yeah.
It was the one, for me, it was the least effective. I thought the monsters were neat. Like, I thought the thing that looked like a, I don't know what, like a fawn, looked good and really benefited from the fact that we only saw it for a few seconds.
All you needed.
And it wasn't super scary, but I did like it.
And it obviously affected the kid. Like, he was, like, his entire life was undone by that experience. And again, that catatonia, it reflects the Andy Nyman character, but it feels the most adjacent, like, different from the stories to me.
Well, and there's also that scene where they were in the kid's room, and the doors were bolted, and he was yelling at his parents earlier, and then there was something at the door, and he said, "I hear you there." And it could be his parents, but you kind of get the feeling that it's this monster from the forest that isn't leaving him alone.
Yeah. And that sort of weighing paranoia. I also think he's the kid's younger and just committing to a bad decision, because we know that that's sort of where the Andy Nyman character's at. He witnessed a kid being lured into this tunnel and have a terrible thing happen to him, and he's not necessarily the reason that the kid died, but he could have stopped it from happening. Instead, he just sort of stood there catatonic and watched it play out, and that's sort of what led to a suicide attempt, which is what led to his coma, which is what led to all of the stuff that we are seeing. So I would really love to know how they presented this on stage.
I would assume that they're actually just telling the stories on stage.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, honestly, I don't know.
Maybe you can do it with, like, I don't know, turn the house lights low and do it with sound design more than anything. Sound design in shadows.
Yeah. I'm not sure.
That little girl ghost was scary as shit.
Oh, for sure. Well, and that's the thing. Like, it's got all these balls in the air. It's, you know, trying to mislead you and successfully misleading you. It's going into his past without, you know, overtly showing you a flashback. And it's still being a frightening horror movie. Because I think a lot of the times, if you're getting all busy in, like, how you're manipulating the audience and how these tethers of plot are going to connect in what way, you kind of forget the scares. And I don't think that happened here. You're talking about the security guard. Speaking as someone who works nights as a security guard, you're in a vulnerable position. I don't understand why there's not more horror movies about security guards, honestly, because you want somebody who's by themselves in a spooky environment and they can't leave for some reason. That's a security guard, right?
Yeah.
So,
I guess there's lots of security guards that die in horror movies, but not a lot that are, like, the subject of the horror.
Right. Like, I think, like, you get hired to be a security guard on, I don't know, an old university campus, and it's, I don't know, it's got squatters in it, or it's got ghosts in it, or it's got blank in it. I feel like there's something there, anyway. every bit of the movie, whether you realize it or not, is feeding you towards this ending. And even like the last story where it's this guy's waiting for, telling a story about waiting for his son to be born and how the son was different, but he loved him anyway. Thematically, it all does resonate, but maybe not until the second or third time you watch the movie. It's asking an awful lot of its audience. It's not talking down to us. And I guess in the horror genre, I kind of appreciate that. So maybe it got a little bit higher up on my list of the decade for that reason. I feel like it. I see the cracks more the more I watch it, I guess is what I'm saying. But I respect it a lot.
I think I told you when I moved from, because I used to do only ghosts on this podcast.
That's right.
I moved to monsters or cults. And I think I mentioned that I used to like ghost movies, but I was kind of over them. Like, I just got overexposed and you just get used to everything. And this one, it's one that I can still like. Like, I think it's a really good ghost movie. Like I said, it's got all of the tropes, but it doesn't really matter just because of how well every bit of it is put together.
Well, and I remember you saying once about The Sixth Sense that you feel like it was a single-use movie for you, like you could watch it exactly once. I don't entirely agree with that assessment of The Sixth Sense, but I definitely don't think that's the case here. I think that once you know the twist, when you go back, you can get more out of this movie. The jump scares might be diluted, but there's actually quite a lot to this movie. It's not just another ghost story.
The jump scares got me the second time around. Like, I don't know if they'd get me the third time around, but yeah, I think it's got rewatchability. I think it's got legs.
From six of the leading graphic artists of our time comes a film that reinvents the meaning of terror.
Okay, so Fears of the Dark, it's a French black and white animated anthology. The wraparound, I guess, is very vague. There's sort of this narration of this French woman talking about things that scare her, and there's this image of this guy leading a pack of dogs through this village and attacking people. We keep cutting back to those two things while we have these stories. There's a story of a guy who has some sort of bug infestation in his bed. There's a story of a little girl who's having a series of nightmares. And there's a story about a guy who's trying to sleep in a weird, creepy house. And it's all hyper-stylized. It reminds me of the old National Film Board shorts that I used to watch as a kid. And reminds me a lot of the movie that you and I reviewed years and years ago, the Edgar Allan Poe Extraordinary Tales. Only those ones had clear anchor points with the Edgar Allan Poe tales and, you know, dialogue. Whereas this is all very visual and aesthetic and presentational, I guess. Like, I feel like you could speak any language and you could watch this movie and you would sort of get the basic A, B, and C of what was going on. But because it is...
Skype
lag. I get it.
When I'm on Skype. The one, you can't even really call it a wraparound because it doesn't wrap around the whole thing, but it's like this 18th century, I don't know what, evil Frenchman with this pack of dogs, and it'll just like cut to it, and you know, he'll let one dog off the leash and it will kill somebody, and then there'll be the story and then somebody else, but it ends before the rest of the films are done. And it also seems like, I thought it was neat, I liked the animation through all of this, but it didn't seem particularly related to anything. Like, didn't seem thematically related, and it wasn't a frame. It wasn't like, you know, each of these peasants had a story to tell. Like, it was just more interspersed than a frame narrative.
That's what I felt. I feel like it was a movie made by several different people and then sort of spliced together into one movie. Like, I don't see a uniform vision here, and maybe that was never the point of it, but
all of the animation styles were slightly different, so I had the sense that it was different teams of animators, and each of them just, you know, you've got 10 minutes to tell a story.
Yeah, and that feels intuitively right, but I think that sort of makes the movie kind of hard to put your hands on. It's just moment to moment what you feel, what the vibe is, and it's a very... it's an experience in aesthetics, and I don't mind watching it. I found it weirdly hypnotizing, actually, watching it. I love the style of animation, especially the old guy by himself in that house, where a lot of it is just lit by candle. I just think this style of the animation is awesome. I don't know that I could say at any point I felt fear. There's something gross about the bug story. There's something kind of unpleasant about the imagery. It's strange, strange, fascinating movie. I don't dislike it, but I sit here kind of struggling what to say about it, how to sell it to somebody. Each individual story has its own form, but all taken together, it's just kind of this heap of images that you just sort of take in and maybe will affect your dream life in some way, but it's hard to process or analyze. Like, I think you'll know by our description if this is up your alley, but it's a very unique movie. But I have a hard time describing it even.
I could recommend it on the animation, and particularly the guy in the house. That animation was really good because it was almost all negative space. Because the house was dark, so most of the frame was always dark, and like if a door was open, you know, like a triangle of light would illuminate things, and you get a sense that there's a ghost or something awful in the house. You don't even know really, you never know why he's there in the first place, and you never exactly know what's going on. I can't say it does a good job of creating suspense. It does a good job of creating a vibe.
Yes.
I think it's the kind of thing that could be on in the background, or it's the kind of thing that could be played without sound, like in a projected on the wall in a hipster bar or something like that, because you really can just drift in and out.
Yeah, or play your favorite album or something.
I think we come down on the same place where, like, it's good. It's unquestionably good. I didn't find it super engaging. The first story where, like, the nerdy kid finds this weird bug in the forest, and then it escapes, and then he goes off to college, and there's this beautiful woman who's inexplicably attracted to him, which was kind of cheesing me off because I don't like that trope particularly. But then it turns out she's been infested by this bug, or maybe she is the bug, and she's fattening him up so that she can lay larvae in him. And at the end, he's like tied up to the bed, and his body is like this breeding factory, and it's gross and it's really sad. I think that's the one that got me the most emotionally. But yeah, the one that I would say I would recommend the most was the last one. I think it had the best animation.
Yeah.
And then there was one that was a Japanese ghost story.
She kept on having these nightmares.
Yeah, and I liked the weirdo Japanese ghosts that were in it. I don't know, I didn't really know what was going on with it.
It's loudly the least memorable, even over the interstitial dog attacks and the pretentious French narration of things that I am afraid of. There were a few moments where we just saw colors and shapes and listened to narration where I kind of felt this is killing time. This is us getting this to a feature-length running time, isn't it?
It could be. I mean, I would give it the benefit of the doubt. All of these, to me, felt like somebody had a vision. That one had, you know, the weakest vision of them all, I thought. And then there was the one, like, it was a small town, and there was some sort of a monster. Like, people would keep going missing, and the
That's
kid's
right.
best friend went missing. And that one really reminded me of telling ghost stories with my best friend, you know, like when we were 7 or 8 years old. And it was a little bit ambiguous. Like, was his best friend the monster? Was his best friend killed by the monster? In the end, they killed this crocodile that happened to be near the town. So was the crocodile the monster? It was neat.
There's no closure to any of the stories I noticed, too. Like, we leave the guy in the bed as a bug factory, or we leave the girl in the midst of her nightmare, or we leave the guy with the uncertainty of, you know, is the evil defeated? Or, like, I guess, even the old man in the house, we don't really know why he's there or what his ultimate fate will be. But it's all...
No, there's the kids outside that he's screaming at them. He wants them to help him. They think that he's yelling at them because they were throwing snowballs at the house, and they run away, and it's just his face in the window is the last shot, and we have no idea what's in the house. We can guess something not good's going to happen to him.
But I think a lot of ways it's got the art house quality where I think it's asking the audience to do a lot of the work and to meet them halfway. And I am the guy who can do that. But I am also the guy who can recognize that not everybody will. There might be a little bit of a whiff of pretentiousness to this here and there. But I like the format. I like anthologies. I like animation. I think it's kind of cool that it's specifically black and white. You don't necessarily see that as often. And I liked it, but I don't know. I have a hard time knowing how to, like, endorse it to somebody. Like, Fears of the Dark. It's an animated anthology. I don't know what else to tell you. Like,
no, it's the kind of thing that would be playing at, like, an art house theater during a Halloween film festival.
And maybe should be discovered by that crowd, because I don't feel like there's a lot of noise around this movie. I don't feel like it's super well known, you know? That's the day and age that we're in, where really interesting movies like this come and go without any recognition at all. I don't necessarily think it's amazing, but I do think it's interesting and worth watching. But that's about it.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. I don't regret the time that I spent with it. I probably wouldn't watch it again. But I think it's for somebody. Like, if somebody would be into it, I think they'd be really into it.
Oh, yeah. In the same way there's somebody who this could be toxic to, there's someone else who this is their favorite movie ever. But it has that latitude within it. I guess at the risk of sounding like I'm copping out, just watch it and make up your own mind.
Yeah, that's where I would go. It's a very specific movie.
There is no light without darkness, no life without death, no peace without war, no God without Satan.
What are you doing, man? I said pull over! I want a broken neck! You're not gonna wreck us. Oh no? So why don't you call it? Look out!
If you can't see the black heart of America, you're either blind or a fool.
Follow me and be free! Yeah!
Just a man with a tent filled with wonders and a handful of stories in search of a willing audience. Do you have a time for a story?
...1997, Quicksilver Highway, would have been a TV series hosted by Christopher Lloyd had it been picked up, but they only produced 2 episodes, and they cut it together into this movie. And Christopher Lloyd is, I don't know, some guy's driving around with this big truck full of magical items and whatnot, stopping here and there.
The trailer, I think the type of trailer is called a Quicksilver. I think
there you go.
It was called Quicksilver Highway.
Well, that's clever. That's appropriate titling on their part.
Yeah, there you go.
But he's...
So there's levels to this movie.
Nailed it. So he is going to find people that very specific and going to tell them a story that's going to teach them a very specific lesson about themselves. And it's going to be presumably related to some object that he has within this trailer that he has in. I like Christopher Lloyd. He's a big actor. Like, unapologetically, he gives it 110% every time. But I don't know. There's something about that dude that I give him a pass. Yeah, he's cartoon big. He's like, you got to be careful how you cast him. But I'm not going to say anything bad about Christopher Lloyd. It's interesting, the two stories that they're choosing here. They have The Chattering Teeth by Stephen King, and The Body Politic by Clive Barker. Two of the most, I would say, difficult to adapt stories from each of them. Like, Stephen King on the level of the absurdity, and Clive Barker just on the level of visceral ugliness. It's how it's described and explained in his text that will never get across in a movie. Like, it's, you can see a hand crawling off the floor. And you, sorry?
Just, it sure didn't come across in this.
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. But it's one of those things, like I talked about in the introduction, where the premise of the story is so outrageous that it almost needs to just exist on the page. And I think people have a hard time adapting Clive Barker. Clive Barker has a hard time adapting Clive Barker because it's the ugliness on the page. It's the descriptions on the page. It's the perversions within the page, frankly, that are the appeal. And you're never going to get that in a movie, and you're certainly not going to get it in a TV movie. Again, the Stephen King story is about a guy who buys a pair of chattering teeth for his kid, and then he ends up getting carjacked, and the teeth help him out of a bad situation. Why or how that is happening is never really addressed, and the teeth are left to be wandering the desert, just chomping away. And it's just absurd.
Well, except for, it begins with this newlywed couple, like she's still in her bride's gown and he's in his tuxedo. Their car breaks down, he goes for gas, and then she's waiting for a long time. Christopher Lloyd comes, invites her into his trailer, which is much bigger on the inside than it is on the outside, and he tells the story. One of the things that it did that I thought was pretty interesting is the characters from the frame narrative are also the characters in the story.
They play the characters in the story.
Yeah, he's the traveling salesman. With the chattering teeth, so he's in this rest stop during this dust storm, and there's this sketchy looking character, and the gas station attendant is really trying to push these chattering teeth on him. Originally they're $15, but he talks, like, the attendant talks him down to 10 and then 5 and then just gives it to him. So I had the sense that these chattering teeth were helpful, that he sensed danger, and then lo and behold, the guy hitches a ride, and he's going to carjack and murder this guy, but then the chattering teeth kill him and also rescue the guy who's trapped in the seatbelt, but then also they presumably kill the guy and presumably kill the husband in the frame narrative. And so what I thought it was with them, originally I thought the chattering teeth were kind of like this instrument of divine justice, but when the hitchhiker, like the car flips over, the hitchhiker, so the guy's trapped, the hitchhiker's going to kill him, and then the chattering teeth walk out, and then the hitchhiker pretends that they're biting him, and they're nothing, no big deal, but then he says, "Do you want to bite me?" And then they start biting and killing him. And then when the salesman, like years later, returns to the gas station, the teeth are there, and the one attendant gives them to him, and he's like joking around, and he looks at them and says, "Oh, do you guys want to bite me?" And I think the idea is, like, when you say that to them, that they become hostile to you. They're neither good nor bad.
Right.
They just, like, they have that trigger.
Well, the thing about the story in both cases, in the book and in here, is that it's just not explained at all. The chattering teeth just do that thing. Like, and it's the absurdity.
And then they're pulling the husband's body through the desert at the end in the frame narrative, so I guess he's run into them.
Yeah, somehow. Again,
I did actually really like that it said the moral of the story. There's like no moral of the story. There's no lesson to be learned.
But as strange as that is, it just doesn't hold a candle to the Clive Barker story, does it?
No, that one was just... it was weird in a way that was a little enjoyable, but more annoying than enjoyable to me.
No, I don't think it works at all, but I just think it's a weird choice for an adaptation, and a weird choice for a TV show. Like, these are the first two things you're going to produce. You're going to put it in front of a test audience and some producers to see whether or not they're going to make this into a series. So you're going to want to make these first two episodes as high quality as you possibly can. Why these stories? Like, again, if the series had been picked up, would they have chosen horror stories? Or are they deliberately choosing absurd? Like, was that a conscious choice? Because it doesn't seem like the Chattering Teeth and the Body Politic are the two most saleable items from Clive Barker and Stephen King's catalog. And it's not like they don't have hundreds of short stories each. So, like, why these stories in earnest?
Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know if Clive Barker and Stephen King were just giving them the dregs because they didn't have a lot of faith in this show. Although Stephen King would just license his stories to anybody for a dollar, so...
Yeah.
Like, who knows?
So in The Body Politic, we have, you know... I think they're sort of speaking on obsessive surgeries and the need to change oneself physically and thinking that that's going to reflect mentally. And then somehow it's about living body parts, chasing people around a hospital. And I think...
Which would be good if the, or could be okay if the hands, like, there's like a revolution of body parts that are going on and they're speaking in these squeaking voices, which my voice can't go in that register, so I'm not trying to do it. And they're like, yeah, that's pretty good. Like, the revolution's gonna happen tonight. Like, come, brothers and sisters, follow us. But it's in this, like, silly Alvin and the Chipmunks voice. And it was really unclear what tone they were trying to strike with that.
Well, it's impossible to take it seriously. And, like, I have a look on my face like I'm trying to laugh, but I can't really laugh either. I'm just like, holy shit, you guys, seriously? And in a weird way, honestly, respect. Like, they went for it. Like, this was a very, very deeply odd thing that they were attempting, but... No, it doesn't work. The Chattering Teeth kind of barely works on the basis of its absurdity, but the second story, I think, is just a complete wash. Like, no. And I defend Clive Barker.
And the second story had Matt Frewer, and I like Matt Frewer.
Good actor.
I thought he gave a good performance in it.
And again, I wonder if he knew what it was going to look like, right? When you're on set... You're not working with the chipmunk hands and the janky special effects. So you're just committing as much as you can to the character and the story and doing the job on the day. And then you actually watch the movie like 6 months later and you're like, oh no.
So I went on Wikipedia for this one because I was so perplexed by the whole situation.
Right.
Apparently the story really affected Matt Frewer. He was having nightmares about it for a long time afterwards.
Huh. Strange. Well, again, maybe he read the story and he had this image in his head of what the thing could be. Because honestly, watching the movie now, it got me much closer to laughter than to fear. Like...
When his hand started talking about the revolution, I kind of thought it might just be a full-on comedy, but it wasn't funny enough to be a full-on comedy.
No, it's, again, an absurd idea that Clive Barker felt the need to put on paper. But again, if you look at all the books of blood and all the different stories that he's written, there are plenty of basic, simple monster movie stories, basic revenge stories, basic, like, everything that you would want for an anthology. There's plenty to choose from. So I sit here mystified by the selection. In a weird way, the Chattering Teeth you might be able to pull off. I don't know that they necessarily 100% did, but just the reality of those teeth actually worked better in film than I imagined upon reading the short story. Whereas in the Clive Barker thing, I don't think it worked at all. Not even accidentally, not even for a minute. So, unfortunately, that cuts the quality of this movie pretty much right down the middle for me. I can make excuses for half of it, and I can't make excuses for the other half of it.
It also makes sense that this was a failed TV show, and they just looped the two episodes together, because usually there's three in an anthology. There's at least three.
Yeah.
The whole Quicksilver Highway thing, it felt like just like shit that they had to cobble together.
Or again, if they had one more episode to include and they could cut 10 minutes out of each of them. Because again, I think that they are longer than they need to be at this length. George Romero and Dario Argento did an anthology, Two Evil Eyes. And they both did a story and they're both an hour long. And I think that maybe half an hour per story, and that's a much better movie, right? I think the benefit of the anthology is you get in quick and you get the job done. And I think maybe they forgot that here. But again, points for choosing really difficult stories to adapt, I guess.
I suppose a big swing and a miss, but at least it was a big swing.
And again, I will not say anything bad about Christopher Lloyd. That's just not going to happen here.
No, although I didn't really like his character design very much, but whatever.
I just like that dude.
Like he looked like a weird emo kid, which is, you know, when you're an elderly man, it doesn't quite fit.
No. He's out of time and place, and I get what they're going for, but I also get why this was not picked up into a series.
Yes.
Six anthology horror movies. Thank you so much for taking this one on the chin. I know I force fed you these, so you've been a good sport. And I know that there were some...
I liked this one.
There are some ups and downs, but I think I mainly had fun with them too. I do find that a lot of these movies, in my heart, I want them to be better than they are, but I do still enjoy watching them. What was your least favorite of these six anthologies and why?
Well, I think it should come as no surprise that it was Quicksilver Highway, which was one, as you said, one that you could make excuses for and one that you absolutely couldn't, so it doesn't really leave us with much.
Yeah.
And I think this is the only one that I would say give a pass. Like, even if you like this kind of thing, there's better anthologies out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, they get hard after this. The number six and number one are pretty obvious to me. Strengths and weaknesses up and down the list. The next one, I don't know if film people might take umbrage, but I would put Fears of the Dark at number five. It was good. It was even better than a lot of the ones ahead of it, but it was also kind of a bit boring at points, and I don't know. It was more of like a visual melange than an actual movie. I don't know. It didn't appeal to me that much. Next, I would put Body Bags, which I liked certain parts of it. Interestingly, you and I liked different parts. The one that I liked the least, you liked the most, but that just speaks for the variety of what you're seeing here.
I might have liked it for the wrong reasons, though.
The next ones get really hard, because I want to put Creepshow 2 higher, because it was such an important movie to me when I was a kid, and I liked The Raft so much, and it's also it's also creative. Like, even say what you will about Chief Woodenhead, it's not, you know, a car breaks down on the highway. It is a very original story, no matter how poorly executed. But The Raft was great. I liked The Hitcher. Tales from the Dark Side, I liked the new twist on classic stories. The cast was very good. That's number two. And then number one, I think uncontroversially, is Ghost Stories. Ghost Stories is the one that I would recommend to anybody. I think it's just like a solid movie, not even solid for this list. It's just,
yeah,
it announces itself as number one.
For sure. And like, it was my number one as well. And I feel like it's doing the most too. It is kind of a loose anthology, but as far as we're talking about the wraparound story for this is really something else. And it just has more depth than any of the other movies and more going on. So yes, everybody else was competing for second place in this list. And in typical Matt and Larry form, our lists are incredibly close, but not quite. Quicksilver Highway was very obviously the least good of these movies. So yeah, it's at the bottom. But I put Body Bags in fifth place. Just, it's uneven. It's undeniably uneven. And even the things I liked about it, I kind of liked for the wrong reasons. I think if you aren't familiar with this sort of early 90s aesthetic, that the stuff that we liked about the movie would probably be drained from it, and it would just feel like a cheap, forgettable, you know, anthology. It's unkind, but there it is in fifth place. I put Fears of the Dark in fourth place because it's just right in the middle for me. Like, I don't dislike it, but I'm not excited by it. I found it strangely hypnotizing and enjoyable to watch, but I had a hard time remembering points to bring up during the review. It didn't leave an impression that deeply, so. But again, we're mostly on the same page here. Creepshow 2 would have been higher on the list when I was younger, but yeah, Old Chief Woodenhead, not only has it not aged particularly well as far as like the politics of it, for a half an hour story, it just feels like it's in slow motion. It's really punishing, and it's the first story, so that kind of demoted it to third place. Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, there's no like standout weak story in it. There may not be no story like The Raft that like absolutely knocks it out of the park and like elevates it to a different level, but I think each individual story does the job. And I think the wraparound story is charming enough. So yes, second place. And as discussed, the Ghost Stories, like, it's a meal. It's a meal. There's more to this than you would anticipate. And I'm sorry if you listened to this before you watched the movie because it wrecked a lot of things for you, but even though you would go in knowing that, I still think there's a meal here to be found. Good performances, good storytelling, and a couple of good jumps. That's what we come to see. So, yes, in first place, Ghost Stories. But the fact that we switched on Body Bags and Fears of the Dark, like, I do not feel passionately about those two movies. Like, it's just, yet again, it's a middle movie that fucks the list for us, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I can agree with you. Fears of the Dark is better than Body Bags. I just, you know, my criteria was the enjoyment I got out of it. And yeah, it was just, it was good, but it didn't grab me.
Again, it's one of those things where we're so close, like I could just switch the list to give you the win, but I gotta be real about it. That's the list I made, that's the list you made, but we're still gonna part friends here.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, we've matched once or twice, but I think basically we always just get two that don't match, so it's fine. We can still be friends.
We're consistent. Is there anything you'd like to say to the good people on the internet before we sign off this episode, the 260th episode of Rank and Review?
No, I don't know. Hi, Internet.
All right. Thanks for being here, as always, brother. And I'm sure we'll be hearing from Matthew Risling again, if he's not in Germany. There it is. We got a lot of horror stories down and reviewed and talked about this episode. And there's plenty to say. I'm sure there's plenty that we missed. And you can send that feedback to rankandreview@gmail.com. That's RANKNREVIEW@gmail.com. The website is rankandreview.ca. Please support my friend Jason's show, The Shelf Shedding Movie Show. He's a local podcast to me, and he's a good friend of mine, and he's good people, damn it. So support his show. And do understand that Rankin Review shall continue to drop every other Wednesday until we hit episode 275. At which time, I'm going to take a much-earned break. Thank you. Tell that other movie fan in your life about Rankin Review, and stay cool, people. Stay cool. Thank you.